Welcome back, everyone. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 1. This is going to be an exciting season. Sam and I took a little break after the holidays. I'm going to read a little story about why bats can't see well. Then we've got a special guest that we'll introduce here in a bit. We're going to talk about food kitchens on the border. Sam joins the interview a little bit late, but that's Sam, right? Then at the end of the show, I'm going to read The Vision of Kitchen Manitou from a book called Ojibwe Heritage by Basil Johnson. So stick around. This will be an exciting episode. Bat was married. He was married to two mallard duck women. He went hunting all the time. He hunted in the mountains. In the mountains, he went west, he went north, he went all along the creek, up and down. He'd go and take fir limbs, and he'd lay them down facing up. Get ready for this. He would turn his belly inside out, pull out his liver, and cut it up. Now remember, the liver regenerates. So this is what really kind of makes, as a scientific part of the story, your liver always grows back. And the bat knows this, right? So anyway, so the bat, he pulled out his liver, he cuts it up, he stands right back up, he sews his belly and takes the liver home, and he feeds his wife. He does this all the time. He's always feeding his wife's, the ducks, his liver. Then one day when the duck woman says, and it was the youngest one, she goes, "This is so bad. I'm tired of eating this food. It just tastes so bad. It has a stink to it." And the older one says, "Sis, what's the matter with you? You always talk too much." The younger one said, "Well, let's go see what he's hunting, what he's killing. What is he feeding us?" So one day when the bat went out, the ducks followed. They went and watched him. They watched him go downstream all alone, and they followed him. He went down to the he went downhill to the north. He laid on his back. He turned his belly inside out, and he took out his liver. They saw that, and they ran home. They grabbed all their stuff, their bags, their purses, all their mallard clothing, and they hauled butt. They left. When Bat came home, he noticed that the two were missing. And he got really sad because the Bat, he loved the mallard ducks. They were his loves. So he went out searching for them. A one-man search party. He searched everywhere. Went upstream, downstream, far and near. But he did not meet them anywhere. And then finally, he saw a gray squirrel who was climbing and cutting pine cones. And Bat goes, "Have you seen my wives, the duck wives?" He goes, "I don't know where they went to." And the gray squirrel didn't answer. He just kept on cutting his pine cones. And Bat spoke again, but this time he's a little bit more fierce and angry. He goes, "Hey, have you seen my wives? Have you seen anyone here?" And the gray squirrel got mad. He got super angry. He said, "You know what? Come over here underneath this tree. Get close. Look up. Close your eyes, and I'll tell you where your wives are." And the Bat said, "Okay." He went over there and closed his eyes and looked up, and when he did, the gray squirrel dropped some pitch in his eyes. The bat goes, "I'm blind, I'm blind. Something fell in my eyes. Give me something to take out this pitch." The gray squirrel ran off and left the bat blind. As the bat sat there, he looked around and kept feeling for something. Finally, he found a pine needle. So he poked his eyes. He goes, "Okay, I can see a little. I can see a little." And he went back off looking for his wives. And so today on our show, we have Angela Sayre. She's from Dallas, Texas, formerly from Oklahoma, my little sister. Give her a round of applause, right? Yay! How are you doing, Angela?
I'm good. How are you, brother?
Good. Hey, anytime Sam might pop in, literally like pop in the studio as in my car. So those listening, Sam may join us or not join us, depending on his driving ability from White Beat, I guess. So you might just pop on in. So we invited Angela on the show today to talk about her work with, I guess it's kind of not a food bank, but what's the best way to describe it, Angela?
Well, World Central Kitchen is the one I've worked with the most, which is basically like a traveling food kitchen. So, yeah.
Wow, a traveling food kitchen. Did y'all do like, I knew you went a couple times to the Mexico border, is that right?
Yeah. So do you want me to just kind of like, the last trip that I did was with World Central Kitchen, and that just kind of we happened into that existence, but it started out going just with like a group of like-minded people from Dallas from my church. Do you
Okay.
want me to just
Yeah.
tell you what was happening?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, break it down for us.
So I don't remember actually what year it was now because it feels like a very long time ago, but whenever they started doing the family separation at the border, there are a couple of people in my church who, they were affected by it in some way. Either it just resonated with us and bothered us enough that we met at protest and realized we needed to do something about it. And then also, there were so many people coming to the border that Dallas was about to be the next big center where they were going to start sending asylum seekers, like refugees from Central America. And we were supposed to get like 3,000 people a day, and our church was going to be one of the groups that was going to take people. So my first trip, I went down there with like 6 or 7 people to see how churches at the at El Paso and Juarez border were processing people, basically.
Yeah.
And that was like totally different from my last trip that I did, and it was honestly very traumatic. Like it is it I haven't talked about it with very many people because it was so many people. Everyone was so traumatized, so dirty, like literally ha dehydrated, literally came across the desert. And if we got someone at a church, it was delivered to us by someone who is considered a coyote, essentially, who got paid to take them there rather than taking them to a detention center. And so we would get like the moms and their kids, or we would get what they would call the pretty people, because they knew that those would be the first to be human trafficked or the
Oh.
equivalent of that. So it was very traumatizing, honestly. Like I had never seen anything like that. And the people who worked there at the church, El Paso is a very big military base
Right.
city. So a lot of them were like, this is like a war zone. We don't see stuff like this in a war zone, right? And it felt that way. I mean, it was very traumatizing. And we had an instance, even where in the middle of the night we were called to go pick up a group of women and children, and they were afraid. We rented a white bus to go down there, so they were afraid to get in the car with us because they didn't know us, and so they wouldn't. And this was when they were having to put people like with ankle monitors and stuff like that. So
Oh,
these
wow.
people had already had been given ankle monitors to be so they could track them wherever they went. They wouldn't get in the car with us. It was like in the middle of the night. So whenever our pastor went back after dropping us off because he thought they were just scared of like the group of people, he went back and they found, I think they just found their ankle monitors and like not the humans,
Oh, wow.
So it was, yeah. So I mean, there were a lot of bad things that happened with that trip that were just very, very overwhelming. And after that, we ended up not being able to take them into Dallas, and I kind of didn't have the chance to go back until, let's see, I did that in May. And then so then the following February, which was this February, I did it again with Team Brownsville, which is a group that's at the border in Brownsville in
Yeah.
Matamoros. And they were setting up, they weren't processing people the same way, because Trump kind of put a stop to like allowing asylum seekers in.
Angela, I'm going to stop you real quick. We will take this time. I'll throw in a commercial. Sam has joined the studio, so.
And if you want to, if our listeners want to support the mission, I guess, of Sam and myself, feel free to go to our webpage. It's anchor.fm/MNO-NIKAN. You can find us on Spotify or whatever helps support us. Just go to our webpage, click support, and a couple options will pop up. It's amazing how far 99 cents will go to two guys like us, right? So, hopefully right now we're actually trying to get money, do some traveling, because I really want to go up north and, you know, really get some good stuff going. So, thank you in advance, Miigwech. All right, back to the show.
Okay, so I kind of already broke down the first trip in El Paso and Juarez, and so the second trip was no longer with the church. So because of the political breakdown of it, churches couldn't do a lot, and we weren't getting asylum seekers in Dallas anymore. So I had a group of people actually from Texas A&M. I think it's their political chapter of their school. I can't think of exactly what it is, but I have a couple of friends there that were professors, and they wanted to go down there so they could learn how to create better policy for asylum seekers. So I went with them, and we ended up joining World Central Food Kitchen, which is by Chef Andre Joseas, who is like a phenomenal person if you ever look him up. So he was basically kind of a restaurateur who decided that, you know, the number one way you could take care of communities, no matter what's going on, is to go in and give them, you know, a smile and really healthy food. And they utilize local restaurants and local people. And since COVID, they've helped keep restaurants open that way, but they've helped, you know, asylum seekers, like when the wildfires happen, they've been there. Like they were at the Capitol this last weekend feeding people, or I guess not this past weekend, like 2 days ago, right? But wherever there's like a disaster, his team shows up, and it's basically just like retired teachers and, you know, people from everywhere who just like care and show up and can donate 2 days or 2 weeks, however long. And they have a really good system of making sure that you're doing something that's beneficial and helpful to the people without kind of getting in the way of anything.
Okay.
So that was my last trip with Brownsville. And then, you know, COVID happened, so I haven't been able to go back since, because now all the asylum seekers, if they weren't sent back to Central America, they're stuck on the opposite side of the border in Mexico, and we're not allowed in, you know, so.
Did you have any run-in with any ICE agents or anything like that?
So whenever we were in El Paso, we for sure did, you know, that the ICE agents, like the guys that I was talking to you about that would drop off the pretty asylum seekers that they called it, you know, like, they were basically kind of working on both sides of it. So they worked with us. So I guess they weren't actually agents, but they worked with us, and they would either deliver people to us that they wanted better care, they would deliver them to the church, or they would deliver people to the detention centers.
Angela,
whenever.
I'm sorry. I wanted to ask a question in there, and you may have already said this, and I just didn't hear it, but do you have any current stat on how many people are down there? Like how many asylum seekers are at the border now?
I don't know how many are there now, but it seems like I think we've turned away like 60,000 people.
60,000 were turned away.
I think so. I think this year.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that because I haven't like looked up any recent numbers.
No, but I understand. I was glad whenever Josh was filling me in on what you did and what we were going to be talking about. I was glad that we were going to be able to talk about this, because it's an issue that whenever I see it, I see a lot of things that I don't necessarily agree with, but I feel like I'm really uninformed about it. And so to get somebody that has a little more firsthand experience with it is beneficial to me. I had no idea that many had been turned away. And did you say most of these folks are coming from Central America?
Yeah.
Okay. And you were in El Paso and then Brownsville?
Yes, Brownsville, which is, it shares the border with Matamoros.
Okay. How many of these detention centers are there total? Do you know?
I don't know. I wish I would have looked some of this up before,
That's
but I
okay.
know that when we were in Brownsville, we went to McAllen and we went to like a couple of different of the detention centers. So some of them, there were private detention centers that, you know, Texas actually has a private detention center quota. So if they don't have 99% of their beds filled, they don't get private. I guess they
Right.
don't get government mandate money
I
back
understand.
to them. So those are like very big cold shells. Like they called those places the ice box because they would be so cold.
Oh.
And they would give them like, you know, something that kind of looks like an aluminum bl kind of blanket
I've
that was just
seen
like a little
those.
square.
I've seen those. I know what you're talking about there.
And then kind of the pop-up ones, the pop-up little shelters in smaller towns that are like in the middle of nowhere, they're just tents, like tents and like a dirty, dirty desert. So, you know, everybody's literally very dirty, like caked dirt on their face. It's really bizarre to see firsthand.
I can I believe it. I'm at a loss for positive questions. You know, like do you have one there, Josh?
Did you have any run-ins with any cartels or anything like that?
So not well, actually, we don't know for sure if it was a cartel, but whenever we were in Matamoros with World Central Kitchen, they had set up a tent, a freestanding tent that they kept there because they were going to be there as long as the Mexico allowed them to be there, right? So they constructed a tent so we would cook in the United States in Brownsville all day long. And then that evening we would bring however many meals we needed to do at this specific camp, which I think was like it was always in the thousands to 2,000, right, meals per day. So w the night that we were there, I think the second night, we had kind of like a tank that was in the street. And it looked like a really old tank, and they were we thought they were border police. And whenever we were serving in the tents, they were walking through with like their guns and everything. And the leader, like our little group leader from World Central Kitchen, was like, "That's not border police, and that's not Matamoros police, so we don't really know who that is." But they legit, you know, had all their machinery, and they were in out. I mean, their outfits looked like. I mean, they had patches and stuff, so we just thought they were police. But they didn't do anything to us. They asked a lot of questions like why we were there, what we were doing. Because, you know, the Mexican side did not like that America wasn't letting Central Americans in, and they couldn't take care of them either, right? So it was the whole policy was remain in Mexico, but these were asylum seekers from Central America, like Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, trying to get through Mexico to America. And so they were in like the most dangerous spot. Like there are more deaths in Matamoros. I think it kind of has rivaled Juarez. Like everyone knows Juarez because of cartel stories.
Right.
But Matamoros had a bunch of scary stories whenever I was looking it up after I left. I'm glad I didn't look them up before I went because I would have been pretty scared. But I mean, there were two gay kids that were in the camp, and one of them came to eat every night. And he was from Matamoros, or he was from somewhere around there. And he felt more comfortable in the asylum seekers camp than he did in town because they kill more, you know, LGBTQ in that town, I guess, than anywhere else. Like, it's like a routine for them to like violently murder them because they don't agree with that lifestyle. So he was in the refugee camp, and I was like really struck by that because, you know, that's wild to run away from home to be in a refugee camp because you feel so unsafe, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's a terrible situation down there. And one of the questions that I've had, and of course I see people making different arguments for this, and they seem like it can go either way, but these people, asylum seekers, why are they leaving where they were born? Is it a lack of opportunity? Are there wars that are going on in their country? Or
Yes.
it okay.
I think it's mostly, I'm sorry.
No. I want to hear what you had to
Well,
say.
so what we've learned basically from the people who have talked to us, which it's actually really, really hard to talk to like any of the asylum seekers, because most of them are pretty traumatized. Like they don't feel comfortable or trust talking to anybody, but there just happened to be a couple of guys, I want to say from like Sweden or something. They were like they spoke like perfect English, but they were, two white documentary guys from like Sweden or something. And so, in Guatemala, they have several different dialects. So it's like, it would be like every single one of our states having a different language. So, like, very much like Native Americans, right? So, but a lot of them could understand each other in the camp, but like, not really. So if you could talk to one group, you couldn't talk to another. But what we heard from the majority of them was that there are major, major kind of drug wars going on there. There are also like power grabs for the government. And a lot of people talk to us about different policies with like the United States. Like, and I don't understand enough about this because I don't really ever find enough written about it. But, everyone has said that we could go into like Central American states and have a more peaceful presence where we could like do kind of like a sanction type thing, or I don't know, but we could do different things to kind of stop their whatever kind of violence is going on with them, because they're such small countries. It's not like Mexico where it's bigger, right? So whatever power grab is happening is because largely economic disparity. And the second part is truly global warming. Like we had a woman and her child who like I gave her like six oranges. She just kept eating oranges, and I was like, man, she hasn't eaten for a long time, but she would like peel the orange, and like she started talking to the guy next to me who was translating, and she hadn't seen an orange in like 3 years. So like they are in a food desert. And whenever there's stuff like that going on, that's whenever, there's kind of a black hole where whoever's the most corrupt can take control and kind of make slaves of everybody, right? Because how else do you give them food? So, like, I don't know exactly what's going on, but I know that definitely the global warming situation mixed with an unstabilized government isn't helping. So, like, one thing that we've all put pressure on, like writing letters and petitions and things like that on our government and on our Texas leaders, is not for a wall. Like a wall isn't going to do anything with Mexico. And it's very confusing because people think this is between like Mexican immigrants, right? And it's like, no, this is asylum seekers. Like these are refugees. Like their homes have been burned down. They have been like most of the people we meet. I mean, we meet children who do not cry. Like, like they are traumatized from seeing war zones. So these are legit asylum seekers. They are not just immigrants. And they're coming here to try to figure out what to do because there's no other option for them where they are. No other option. And so, like, the money that we are spending on this wall, that's like 11, I think the last thing I saw, it was like $11 billion. Like that kind of money should actually go to stabilize those governments because most people don't want to leave their homes, right? Like that's like a false narrative that everybody gives out. So, learning what we can do to help these countries and like be kind of the saviors like America always wants to be is the way forward, not building more walls and not, scaring people. That's only for votes in America,
No,
right?
I
And then
agree.
outside of America, everything's falling apart. But those things will get worse if we don't address them. Like global warming will get worse. We will get more people coming here. Like those destabilized governments will get worse. Like we have to start paying attention to that, or we will get more of this. And people don't understand that.
It's if it, it I may be a little naive in this, and I may look at it from an odd perspective. I see I see all my life, I've seen all these kids that go down to southern Mexico to either Cancun or to these Central American locations. And of course, for them, it's like a vacation spot. And when they come back, well, they don't want to come back. That's what they say. Oh, it was beautiful down there. I loved it down there. And I know that these are little areas that have been fenced off for tourism. But what I don't understand in the mindset of these people that are capable of going down there and starting a business. Like you said, the wall being $11 billion. You could take 1 billion of each of that and help out 11 large communities down there building a type of infrastructure. And if I had a company with 100 employees, I could move my company down there and probably triple the size of it. And the rate of exchange, again, like you said earlier, nobody wants to leave their home. And so I understand where maybe somebody from Iowa wouldn't want to go all the way down there. However, the opportunity to do something down there it's dramatically different than here. I don't know if it's that I don't know if it's those businesses aren't really welcome down there. And I can in some places I can understand. One of the things I wanted to do after I got out of college, I didn't have a lot of I guess direction, and so what I had decided I wanted to do was go down and basically be a groundskeeper at one of these ancient sites in I believe it's Guatemala. And of course I got to talking with people. I met people with connections. And down there was a group called the Zapatistas. And the more I got to know about these Zapatistas, they were local traditional culturists from that area, and they were sick and tired of people like me coming down there and being put in positions that had any charge. And so I kind of respected that. I understood what it was they didn't want more of, and so and I never ended up going. I think that, and again, this is me projecting. We have a lot of things here in America, like where we're sitting now. We're across the street from a big retail market, and I think, and then right behind us is a fast food place, and we get so stuck in this convenience, but whenever you stop looking at it, it's not convenient anymore. We can go over here and we can get a hamburger for $6. That's not convenient. I can go across the street and I can pay just as much at a retail outlet where the products aren't even local. And the funding just keeps going somewhere, and I don't know where, but I know that I know that it's not getting anybody to progress out of this funk. Back when we were kids, they would have just put us through a ringer of PE or two a days to make us do 200 sit-ups, and we'd be sore for a little while and then get going. And I think in a large way, we, those that have grown up with this convenience, I think that we've put more value on convenience than improvement. I hope
Oh,
to
for
see that
sure.
change. Anyway, I'm sorry I got preachy there, but
Sam does get
I
preachy.
do. I do that. I'll take
Well, I can be that way too. I know. I can admit it.
that. All right, bro.
But speaking of that, whenever back to being in El Paso, part of people going into different sides of the world to or of the country to start something or to work for something, friendship bridges in the United States, right? Between sovereign and American land. And I always thought that was a really cool thing. And so around the time I learned of that was around the time I went to El Paso. And that we spent one day with Hope Border Institute. So we were also just understanding, not just the asylum seekers, but we had a day off, so we were wanting to understand like the immigration side of what was going on. And we went to visit the wall with these guys, right, too. So they were talking to us about the symbolism of the wall and what it meant to everyone there. And like So there's this long bridge that goes from El Paso into Juarez, and you pay like a dollar to do it. And it's just like an endless amount of people that come in from Juarez to work in El Paso. So they'll let people come and work over here, but then they send them home. They won't like grant them any kind of immigration, like full status or anything like that. But also, like those people want to live in Juarez, and in Juarez, it's so controlled by cartels that anytime they tried to start something, whereas there are a lot of, it's like in an industrial place, apparently. Like, I didn't really know that, but there are a lot of places there, but they rely on very cheap labor. And I think that might be kind of changing now, but I mean, they were, it always sounded very mob-like, you know, like everything that they did, they had to give back. So I think a lot of these places, another reason why you couldn't go in there, is because A, like you would have to deeply respect the culture, which like we understand that from a native perspective, right? Like that's not always done here. But that's never done whenever white people come into those other countries. They just want to colonize them, and like they feel that, so they don't respect white people coming there and doing anything. You would have to come there the right way and be like, I'm giving everyone here that works with you a fair chance. And we're going to do this together and build this together. Maybe, like, I don't even know the right way you could do it, because the whole point about the bridge in El Paso is that there are walls that like have cut through playgrounds. So even the kids on like the Mexican side of the border, theirs is like completely run down, and the kids on the other side, it's like a little more upkept and stuff, but it's a symbol that forces people to be kept in their place, right? Like whenever you see what side you live on, and you're not allowed all the luxuries of the other side, but they want you to work there because you'll work for cheaper. It's kind of like you're not good enough society. It's like a caste system thing mentality, to a big symbol to keep you in your place, right? And that's what the wall has been the whole time.
Hey, Angela, I got is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap this up? Is there like a
I
website or
think,
anything like where the that you know off the top of your head?
yeah, well, you can look up World Central Kitchen on Instagram, and it
World
always shows you
World Central Kitchen on
World
Instagram. Central Kitchen, and what was the chef's name?
Chef, I just went blank because you just Jose Andres.
Jose Andres.
But they have an Instagram, and then you can go in, but they always tell you like the next place they're going to go to, how many people they need help. And like even during COVID, I mean, they're very, very careful, and they just rely on volunteers
How
mostly.
did you
They
sign
have
up,
some
Angela?
full-time people, but
Did you just like go to like a link or something, like to work with the World Kitchen or your group did or?
actually we signed up through Team Brownsville, which was a volunteer group in Brownsville, but I think you can just go to their website and tell them what days you're available, and they'll tell you where there's a need. Like one of the ladies we moved with or went down there with was from Portland, and she went to a new place like every month to work with them because she was retired.
Wow.
So yeah.
Good to hear. Well, I know that COVID's got you kind of held back, but we appreciate the work that you're doing down there. Any act of kindness is going to be helpful moving forward in the world. And
Yeah.
I'd like to talk with you again more whenever I have I guess more intelligent questions. Now this was all about a story, though. People don't know what's going on or didn't know what's going on before till you're actually. I mean, I saw my sister's pictures that she shared, and I probably put one of them actually as a cover on this episode, just because I mean, you really don't know what's going on down there till you actually see like people in a food tent on the border serving food. Pretty mind blowing. You just only get what news media lets us know that what's going on. The info wars, as we call
And yeah, there's a lot more to share about it. So we could talk about this a lot, and next time I could bring better policy, because there is a lot that we can do that people just don't know because we get caught up in the fight of being like, oh, but the border wall. And it's like, that has nothing to do with it,
Right,
guys.
that's a
That will never
distraction.
stop
That's
it.
a distraction
Yeah,
from
it's
the
a
real issue.
distraction. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Angela, we appreciate you doing this with us today. And
Yeah, thanks for having
yeah,
me.
I'm glad Josh has a
I'm
has
glad
some good
Sam
sisters.
showed up. How's that?
Right? Yeah. Wow, I have to be fashionably late. Well, we're gonna go on and wrap this interview on up, and we're gonna do it in about 30 seconds, in case you have anything you and then if I can, I'd like to keep you kind of online for a second.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, do you have anything else you want to add, Angela? We'll just clip it on.
Support real journalism.
Right. Real journalism. All right. Okay. Thank you, Angela.
Territory OKC does it in Oklahoma.
Young and old ask, who gave to me the breath of life? My frame of flesh, who gave to me the beat of heart? My vision to behold, who? When to rose the gift of shade, of beauty, and grace of form? When to pine the gift of mystery, of growth, the power to heal? When? How to bear the gift of sense of time, a place of wintering? How the eagle came the gift, a glance of love, the flash of rage, how? Who gave to sun his light to burn, his path to tread? Who gave to earth her greening bounty, cycles of her being? Who? Who gave to us the gifts we do not own, but borrow and pass on? Who made us? Who set the path of souls? Who carved the land of peace? Who? As the young asked, the old men and women thought about these matters. They gave their answers and explanations in the form of stories, songs, prayers, rituals, and ceremonies. Kitchi Manitou, the Great Spirit, beheld a vision. In this dream, he saw a vast sky filled with stars, sun, moon, and earth. He saw an earth made of mountains and valleys, islands, lakes, plains, and forests. He saw trees and flowers, grasses, and vegetables. He saw walking, flying, swimming, and crawling beings. He witnessed the birth, growth, and end of things. At the same time, he saw other things live on. Amidst change, there was constancy. Kitchi Manitou heard songs, wailing stories. He touched the wind and rain. He felt love and hate, fear, the courage, joy, and sadness. Kitchi Manitou meditated to understand his vision. In his wisdom, Kitchi Manitou understood the vision had to be fulfilled. Kitchi Manitou was to bring into being and existence what he seen, heard, or felt. I'm going to stop right there. Being that this was written earlier, you know, it's always, they always write everything as he, or she. But, you know, being a spirit, it's not going to be a he or a she. I'm going to continue on now. Out of nothing, he made rock, water, fire, and wind. And to each one, he breathed the breath of life. On each one, he bestowed with his breath a different essence of nature. Each substance had its own power, which became its soul spirit. From these four substances, Kitchi Manitou created the physical world of sun, stars, moon, and earth. To the sun, Kitchi Manitou gave the powers of light and heat. To the earth, he gave growth and healing. To water, purity and renewal. To the wind, music, and the breath of life itself. On earth, Kitchi Manitou formed mountains, valleys, plains, islands, lakes, bays, and rivers. Everything was in its place. Everything was beautiful. Then Kitchi Manitou made the plant beings. These were four kinds: flowers, grass, trees, and vegetables. To each he gave a spirit of life, growth, healing, and beauty. Each he placed where it would be most beneficial, lend to earth the greatest beauty, harmony, and order. After plants, Kitchi Manitou created animal beings, conferring on each a special powers of nature's. There are two-legged, four-legged, winged, and swimmers. Last of all, he made man. The last in the order of creation, least in the order of dependence, and weakless in bodily powers, man had the greatest gift, the power to dream. Kitchi Manitou then made the great laws of nature for the well-being and harmony of all things and all creatures. The great laws govern the place and movement of the sun, moon, earth, and stars. Govern the powers of the wind, water, fire, and rocks. Govern the rhythm and continuity of life. Rhythm is vibrations. Birth, growth, and decay. All living things work by these laws. Kitchi Manitou had brought into existence his vision. Soon, disaster fell upon the world. Great clouds formed in the skies and spilled water upon the earth until the mountaintops were covered. All that was left was one vast sea. All men died. All the land creatures perished. All the plants were covered by the sea. Only the water animals and birds and fishes lived on. What was once earth was a huge unbroken stretch of water whipped in the foam and weighed by the ferocious winds. The world remained a sea for many generations. At length the rain ceased, the clouds vanished, and the sun shone. High in the heavens there lived a woman, a spirit. Without a companion, she grew despondent. In her solitude, she asked Kichimatu for some means to dispel her loneliness. Taking compassion on the Sky Woman, Kichimatu sent her a spirit to become her consort. The Sky Woman and her companion were happy together. In time, the Spirit Woman conceived. Before she gave birth, her consort left. Alone, she bore two children, one pure spirit and the other pure physical being. The new beings of opposite natures and substances hated one another. In a fiery sky battle, they fought and destroyed each other. After the destruction of her children, the Spirit Woman again lived in solitude. Kichimatu, knowing her desolation, once more sent her a companion. Again, Sky Woman conceived. As before, her consort left, but Sky Woman remained content. Water creatures observed what was happening in the heavens, sensed the weariness of the Spirit Woman, and pitied her. In their compassion, they sought a way to provide relief for her. Eventually, they persuaded a giant turtle to rise to the surface of the waters, offer his back as a heaven. When the great turtle greeted the water beings, invited the Sky Woman to come down. The Sky Woman accepted the invitation, left her abode in the skies, and came down and rested on the back of the great turtle. When the Sky Woman had settled on the turtle, she asked the water animals to get some soil from the bottom of the sea. Gladly, all the animals tried to serve the Spirit Woman. The beaver was the first one to plunge in the depths. He soon surfaced out of breath and felt the precious soil. The fisher tried too, but he failed. The marten went down, came up empty-handed. The loon tried. Although he remained outside a long time, he too merged, grasping for air. He says, too dark. All tried to fulfill the Spirit Woman's request. All failed. All were ashamed. Finally, the least of the creatures, the muskrat, volunteered to dive. At his announcement, the other creatures laughed and scorned because they doubted this little creature's strength and endurance. Had they not who were strong and who had been able to grasp soul from the bottom of the sea, how could a muskrat do it? Nevertheless, the little muskrat determined to dive. Undaunted, he disappeared in the waves. The onlooker smiled. They waited and waited, and time passed and passed, and soon their smiles turned into worried frowns. And, you know, they all hoped that he would have success a little bit, and they kept waiting, and eventually the muskrat floated to the surface, more dead than alive, but in his paws he had some soil. And so where the great failed, the muskrat succeeded. Soon the muskrat was tended and restored to health. The Spirit Woman painted the rim of the turtle's back with a small amount of soil that had been brought to her. She breathed upon it and into it the breath of light. Immediately the soil grew and covered the turtle's back and formed an island. The turtle had given his service, which was no longer required, and he swam away. The island formed in this way was called Michimackinac, the place of the great turtle's back, now known as Michimackinac. Forgive me. I am not very good at pronouncing those M words. That's up north Michigan, I believe. For his services to mankind, the Spirit Woman, the turtle became the messenger of thought and feeling that flows and flashes between the different natures and orders. He became a symbol of thought, give and receive. The turtle's slowest of all creatures represented celerity and communication between beings. The island home grew in size, and as the waters subsidized, the animal beings brought grasses, flowers, trees, and food-bearing plants to the Sky Woman. To each, she infused her life-giving breath, and they lived once more. In the same way, the animals who were drowned revived. Everything was restored on the island home. A last time came for the Sky Woman to fulfill the promise of life. One cloudless morning, she gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl. The new beings were unlike her first children, who had destroyed each other. They were composite in nature, made up of physical substance and soul-spirit substance. In this respect, they were similar, yet at the same time they encompassed vast differences. One was man, the other was woman. Although they were different, they tended towards union with one another. Neither was complete or fulfilled without the other. Only together did they possess meaning. Only together could they fulfill their purposes. What was unique was the soul-spirit of each. Called Chijok, it's made of six aspects: character, personality, soul, spirit, heart, and a life principle. The substance had the capacity to dream and to receive vision. Through dream and vision, a man would find guidance in attaining fulfillment of self. For men, the vision was necessary for self-fulfillment. For a woman, a vision was not essential. By giving life through the first mother, women were fulfilled. Just as Kichimatu had received a vision and brought to fulfillment, so had men to request for it and live to it once they received it. Men and women had yet another aspect. Each possessed his chiboum, or aurora. It was a substance emanated from his chijiuk, through his body, by which the staying quality of inner being was sensed and felt. The new men and women were called Anishinaabeg, beings made out of nothing, because their substance were not rock or fire or water or wind. They were spontaneous beings. The cycle was complete: creation, destruction, and recreation. The first year, the animal being is nourished and nurtured, the infants and spirit woman. For all their needs of the spirit woman, our children depend upon the care and goodwill of the animals. The bear, wolves, fox, deer, and beaver brought food and drinks. Squirrels, weasels, raccoons, and cats offered toys and games. Robins, sparrows, chickadees, and loons sang and danced in the air. Butterflies and bees and dragonflies made the children smile. All the animal beings served in some tangible way, all except the lowly dog. Sam, Q and Sam, I'm the dog, right? Of all the animal beings, the dog was endowed with the least exceptional power. He was less fleet than the fox. He was weaker than the wolf, less cunning than the mink. Compared to the fish, the dog was a poor swimmer. Besides the deer, the dog was awkward. Less gifted than his brother, the dog had nothing to offer. He could not serve. He felt he had to do something, though. In his despondency, he pledged to give his love. Others could serve according to their natures and capacities. He to his. Consequently, the dog settled down by the side of the bed in which the sleeping infants laid, alternately sitting or lying down. He gazed in the eyes, placed his head near their feet, played and amused them. The baby smiled. From that time on, the dog has never left man. First winter in the life of the Nishnabeg was an ordeal. Food was scarce, winds were harsh. Infants grew sick and lost strength daily. It seemed they would not survive the winter. The spirit woman was disconsolate, and the animals and birds were alarmed that the babies had grown to the love they would die. The bear, fearing the death of the infants, offered himself that they might live. With the bear's sweet flesh, the infants survived. The death of the bear encompassed life for the new beings. Therefore, when the other animals sacrificed their lives for the good men, when the infants grew into manhood and womanhood, they bore a special love for the bear and honored him in their ceremonies. In gratitude and fondness, they dedicated prayer to the other animals I had need. Men and women survived and lived because of the death of their elder brothers. Many years later, when the first Anishinaabeg had grown up and Spirit Woman was certain to their survival, she called her children to her. She told them she was returning to the land of peace, to her proper place of abode. And she told them that when they had lived out their term of life and done sufficient good in life, they too would leave their bodies in the land of living and go to the land of peace as soul spirits and live there another way. Then the spirit woman ascended the sky to return home. Thereafter, the Anishinaabeg remembered the first of mothers, Nokomis, grandmother, whenever the moon gave light. At the same time, they remembered the primacy of woman who bore the unique gift of life. For it's through woman that the cycle, creation, destruction, recreation was completed. For her special gift of giving life and being, women have a special place in the order of existence and are exempt from the vision quest. After the spirit woman returned to her own realm, the Anishinaabeg prospered and increased in numbers. Animals and men and women labored readily and happily together. Micmacnac was a happy home to all. This happy state did not last. A strange and fatal disease affected the Anishinaabeg and threatened to wipe them out. For this dread disease, there was no medicine. From this affliction, no relief or escape was possible. Many died. Fear and sadness prevailed among those who had not yet become ill. One of the victims of this plague was an old young boy, Odaemen. After a short illness, he died, leaving his father, mother, his brothers, and sisters. At death, his soul spirit traveled westward for 4 days along the path of souls before coming to a fog and shrouded ridge. And at the entrance to the land of souls, the boy interceded for life for his people. Restored to life, he related the conditions of amendments to the land of souls and delivered the promise made by Kichimatu that intermediary would teach the Anishinaabeg what was essential for their existence and well-being would be sent. In the meantime, they had to wait the coming of the teacher before their miserable condition could improve. Kichimatu sent Nanabush to teach the Anishinaabeg. So a few things, if you take back, women don't have to do the vision quest because they give life. Men have to do the vision quest because they need to fulfill their life. And we just introduced Nanabush to life. Or Wanabozo. Here he comes. And you can also, if you think about, there's a lot of correlations between Christianity too, between all these stories. You'll notice there's some differences, some the same, man and woman breathing life into the earth. So once again, thank you all for listening to this episode. Thanks for coming on to me and Sam. We promise to have a fun-filled second season. Thank you to our 1,000-plus listeners out there, and thank you to all of our donors who keep this going. Mama P.